I was once told years ago, when they applaud you before you speak, stop while you're still ahead. A few years ago in the United Kingdom, we passed the Equality Act 2006, and while that act was passing through Parliament, there was an incident in a crematorium in Devon where they'd removed their crosses from the crematorium because they said they were concerned that the cross would offend people of other religions. And this entire subject was then debated in the House of Lords while the Equality Act was going through. And the entire debate revolved around the issue of the cross in the crematorium causing offence to Muslims visiting the crematorium. How could that be dealt with? Should the crosses be removed? Should the crosses simply be covered up when Muslim families were there, and so forth? It was an interesting debate. There was just one small problem. Actually, nobody in the debate seemed to be aware of the fact that Muslims don't cremate. It's against their religion. And that epitomised, I think, part of the problem in England, that we have a government which is trying to deal with religious issues, but is doing so from a position really of ignorance in many respects of religious belief or the concepts of religious belief. And this is summed up by Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, very well. The trouble with a lot of government initiatives about faith is they assume it's a problem. It's an eccentricity. It's practiced by oddities, foreigners, and minorities. And that was also backed up by Catholic Archbishop Peter Smith. Religion is a legally permissible private eccentricity allowable behind closed doors. And that's part of the entire subject of religious freedom in Britain, that it is, you're told, well, it's okay, you know, go to church, that's it, keep it all to yourself. But no other organisations are faced with that problem. But religion does have a specific image problem in Britain. And this is part of the problem. Whether one likes it or not, the conflict in Northern Ireland has been perceived in Great Britain entirely in religious terms and with very little understanding or desire to understand the rather more complicated political, cultural and background to it. And so I'm sure you recognise the picture of the Orangeman. The other gentleman is Muhammad Siddiqui Khan, who was this is his suicide video prior to him exploding a bomb in London on July the 7th, 2005. Muhammad Siddiqui Khan and I share something. He was born in the Beeston area of Leeds, so was I. It was a rather different area when I was born. And he is British born, British born Pakistani Muslim, who along with five others exploded bombs in London. And so that's part of the public media image of religion. That's a bomb, a riot in Belfast. And the other picture is one of the buses that was blown up in London. So religion, as I say, has an image problem. It's not just Rowan Williams' idea, it's seen as a private eccentricity. It's seen, I think, subconsciously as a potentially dangerous eccentricity. And that, I think, comes out a little bit in the attitudes to religion in some of the cases that have occurred in Britain. Now, the United Kingdom has a number of different jurisdictions. Northern Ireland has completely different religious discrimination law from the religious discrimination law applying in Scotland, England, and Wales. The Scottish courts are interpreting it slightly differently. So I'm going to concentrate entirely upon cases in England, which is the jurisdiction I know. These are the main legal provisions that have sort of entered the debate in terms of religious freedom in Britain. Human Rights Act 1998, Employment Equality Regulations, and the Human Rights Act was passed in 1998 by the then Labour government, and what it did, it incorporated into United Kingdom law the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, just like the United Kingdom, just like all the other countries of the European Union, all signatories to the European Convention on Human Rights, which is supervised by the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. What the UK did, which was unique, was they incorporated the European Convention directly into UK law and incorporated the case law of the European Convention directly into UK law. That doesn't, and that's different from your own legal position in Ireland, where the reading some of the cases, there is reference obviously to the Irish Constitution, which is the supreme document. The European Convention is used as a bit of a guidance, but it's not directly relevant. And at the time the Human Rights Act was passed, a lot of faith was passed by some common religious believers in Article 9 of the European Convention. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, freedom to change his religion, and to manifest religion or belief in worship, teaching, practice, and observance. It's great, isn't it? And then, of course, Article 9.2 then says freedom to manifest should be subject to limitations prescribed by law. Necessary in a democratic society. Well, how do we define what's necessary in a democratic society? Well, the government says, well, we think it's necessary. Yeah, that's fine by us. Okay, so it's actually quite an interesting comparison between European attitudes to freedom of religion and American attitudes to freedom of religion in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Bill of Rights, they don't actually give people any rights. They assume the citizens have rights, and then they say the government shall not interfere with those rights. European Convention is a little bit different. It sort of says, hi, we're giving you this right. Oh, by the way, government can take it back, which is basically how it's been applied in the UK. And the first major test of the European Convention occurred in the case of this young lady, Shabina Begum. The other lady is called Aisha Azmi. At least as far as I know, that's Aisha Azmi. It could be a picture of just about anybody wearing a niqab. But Shabina became a very devout Muslim girl, and she turned up at school one day wearing a jilbab, which is the all-encompassing garb, and sort of along with her brother, and demanded the right to wear the jilbab come what may in school. That was contrary to school uniform, and it's a case I wish I'd been involved in, because it went to the High Court, the Court of Appeal, and the House of Lords, and I could have retired on the legal fees. Now, Shabina lost her case, and I think rightly so, because what the court did, they said, well, the school did have a uniform policy. That uniform policy had taken account of Muslim sensibilities. The girls were allowed to wear a hijab, a headscarf, and the jilbab was a somewhat more extreme version of Muslim wear. But a particular phrase came out in that case, and it's at the top, and it's by Lord Hoffman. Article 9 does not require that one should be allowed to manifest one's religion any time and place of one's own choosing. And it's quite right. What the circumstance in which Lord Hoffman said it was that on the very first day of school, Shabina, without ever having contacted the school to say, look, I feel I ought to wear the jilbab, I feel it's a religious obligation, etc., she sort of turned up at school with her big brother and wearing the jilbab, and her big brother said, right, you've got to let her wear this, otherwise we'll sue you for breach of her human rights. They said, no, sorry, we've got a uniform policy, right, we're going off to court. That was basically it. And Lord Hoffman's remarks went on to say, common courtesy has a part, even in defending of human rights. But what has happened in the case law that's happened, that particular phrase, which was very understandable in its context has then been used to apply to just about everybody who attempt to rely on Article 9. Ah, well, you can't do it at a time and place of one's own choosing. Next major case with Aisha Azmi, she was a school assistant, and not a teacher, but a school assistant, and she wanted to wear the niqab, that's a face veil, if men were present. She was happy not to wear the face veil when the pupils were present, and if there was a female teacher with her, because she, as a teaching assistant, she didn't teach on her own. But if there was a male teacher, she would insist on wearing the niqab, the face veil. And the problem is, of course, she was teaching the children spoken English, which is very difficult when you're wearing a face veil, in practical terms. But the court said, no, the school were right to be able to say that you can't insist upon wearing the face veil. But they took account of the fact that the school had tried to accommodate her and had looked at all the possibilities. And that was important because how the courts approached the cases of Shabina and Aisha were actually quite different in many respects from the way in which they've then approached others, approaching it from a Christian perspective. And this is part of the real concern that one has. This lady is Lillian Liddell. Lillian was a registrar at Islington Borough Council, and registrar meant registrar of births, marriages, and deaths. And following the passing of the United Kingdom Civil Partnerships Act in 2004, Lillian was redesignated as a civil partnership registrar. Now, I know you've just had your Civil Partnerships Act. And I was very puzzled when I first heard that it was going to be a criminal offence, punishable by imprisonment, for registrars not to perform civil partnerships. And I thought that was quite extraordinary. And then I actually went and had a look at your legislation, and I found that it was actually a criminal offence for them to refuse to perform a marriage, which is, you know, I must admit, speaking British person, a little bit strange for me. I sort of think, have you got all these sort of really awkward registrars refusing to perform marriages that, you know, you have to make it a criminal offence for them not to do it? But there you are, maybe it's the rebel heritage or something, I don't know. Lillian did not refuse to perform civil partnerships. What she did what I suspect everybody in this room at one time or another had done in their workplace. She swapped jobs. So if she was rostered for a civil partnership, she'd swap with one of her colleagues who was quite happy to do civil partnerships. So Lillian carried on doing the marriages, the civil partnerships were done. And it was very important to stress, it was very clear throughout all the legal proceedings, not one civil partnership was ever affected by Lillian. No person who ever came to Islington Council for a civil partnership even knew about Lillian. And the service carried on perfectly adequately. She didn't just sit around doing nothing. She was working the entire time. You might have thought on a purely pragmatic live and let live view, that would have been okay. No, it wasn't. Two gay members of staff complained about Lillian, and not that they were affected, but that they disagreed with her. And she was ordered to do civil partnerships. She said, look, you know, it is against my religious convictions. And she went to an employment tribunal. And the employment tribunal, she won at the employment tribunal. And the employment tribunal said, this is a case where there's a direct conflict between the legislative protection afforded to religion and belief and the legislative protection afforded to sexual orientation. One set of rights cannot overrule the other set of rights. So what the tribunal was saying was, we've got a balance here. And provided the service can carry on, provided Islington Council isn't being stopped from offering its service, provided the work of this employee isn't disrupting the employer, you know, she should be allowed to have her conscientious objection. And that was very much what was assumed would be the situation when the religion and belief employment regulations were brought in. Because the example was given, well, what about a Muslim employee who doesn't want to handle pork? Well, if you're a Muslim employee in a butcher's and there's only two butchers there, sorry, you're going to have to handle pork. If you're a Muslim employee in a very large supermarket, it might be quite practical, no real problem, for you not to be the one who handles the pork. You know, just ordinary, you know, how significant is it? But that wasn't the approach that was taken in the case. And this is the legislation, and without going through it too much, it's applying a criteria which A, which is the employer, cannot show to be a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Proportionality is essential to law. You know, the idea is that whether something is wrong or right depends upon the time, the place, the circumstances. In simple terms, if you're at the All-Ireland match yelling your head off, that's probably quite acceptable. If you're sort of standing, if you're doing that in the middle of O'Connell Street, you might well get arrested. I don't know. But, you know, time and place are very important. There is a balancing exercise. Right. Okay. And apparently I'm not speaking loudly enough. Ah, right. I'll stop the movement. So, what happened? She won at the Employment Tribunal, and that then went to the Employment Appeals Tribunal, then to the Court of Appeal. And it was quite an extraordinary judgment by the Court of Appeal. They said that Islington Towns were right to oblige Lillian to perform civil partnership ceremonies despite her religious objection, because Ms. Liddell's objection was based on her view of marriage, which was not a core part of her religion. Not a core part of her religion. And Islington's requirement in no way prevented her from worshipping as she wished. Well, great. I mean, you can justify almost any discrimination on that basis. We don't employ Catholics here, and you go to an employment tribunal. Oh, well, that doesn't stop you worshipping as a Catholic, does it? Well, fine. No, of course it doesn't. Discrimination law isn't dealing directly with the issue of does it stop you worshipping. But it's not a core part of her religion. And frankly, what was never faced up to by the court is what right does a civil, secular court have to determine what is a core part of a religion? But the court did assume that right. I mean, which I think most Christians would say, well, actually, yeah, we do regard marriage and sanctity of marriage as possibly a core part of the religion. But they also went on. They gave hypothetical examples. They said, well, what happens if she happened to believe that it was right to blow up an abortion clinic, but she then claimed she shouldn't be sacked? Now, as a lawyer, the one thing you learn is you don't put hypothetical examples to judges. Judges tell you, well, I'm not here to deal with hypothetical examples, Mr. Addison. I want to deal with the practicalities of this case. And as a lawyer, I respect that. Well, the Court of Appeal went way off into the stratosphere on hypotheticals. But they also said it would have been no more acceptable for someone, Ms. Liddell's views, to refuse to perform civil partnership than it would have been for a militant gay registrar to refuse to perform marriage between people who, for religious reasons, objected to homosexual relationships. And that, I think, hits the core problem of which the courts are failing to understand religious belief. They are failing to understand the concept of moral complicity in an immoral act. In simple terms, if there is a moral difference between giving a gay couple a meal and giving them a double bed for the night, there is in this example that the Master of Rolls, and the Master of Rolls is the most senior civil judge in Britain. The next one above him is the Lord Chief Justice. So it's a very senior judgment. And he was equating Lillian's conscientious objection to performing a civil partnership and being therefore complicit in an immoral relationship and somebody simply disliking the people in front of them, and was unable to sort of understand the difference, because the militant gay registrar, he gives this example here, by marrying two religious persons, isn't in any way conforming to their views, or complicit in their views, or agreeing with their views. But there is no moral objection, it's merely a dislike of the people. But that was nevertheless what the highest civil court in the country said. And I still believe very firmly that the employment tribunal had the balance right. It had got the structure right. That there was a balance in these things. And in society, what we proclaim to be a tolerant and liberal society, and one of our recent, a columnist in Britain recently wrote, Britain is a tolerant and liberal society, and we will arrest anybody who says that it isn't. A tolerant liberal society surely has the place for balance. No, not according to the Court of Appeal. Now, we moved on from there to another case which went over much the same argument, McFarlane. And he worked for Relate Counselling, who relate counsel people in sexual and emotional problems, and he didn't want to counsel same-sex couples on their sexual problems. Now, you would have thought, possibly an employer might have thought, well, that's actually probably pretty sensible. If you're not really into that, then maybe you can't counsel somebody on it. Anyway, that went on appeal. The Court of Appeal refused leave to appeal. There was an application, and Lord Carey, a former Archbishop of Canterbury, put it, an affidavit in support and saying, well, courts are not understanding religious objections. And Mr. Justice Laws went off into the stratosphere again and said, well, if we give any respect to people's religious beliefs, then we're going to have a theocracy. A theocracy. Well, my understanding of theocracy is you impose religious beliefs on everybody. I don't think it's a theocracy to respect somebody else's religious belief. And Mr. Justice Laws said, the judges, as far as I know, have never sought to equate the condemnation of some Christians of homosexuality with homophobia or regard the position as disreputable. Nor are they likened Christians to bigots. Well, 2 months later, in the UK Supreme Court, Lord Hope, Deputy President of the Supreme Court, in a case called H.J. Iran, which related to asylum seekers from Iran who were gay, homosexual, seeking asylum, referred in his first paragraph to the rampant homophobic teaching that right-wing evangelical Christian churches indulge in throughout much of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's a value judgment. When anybody uses the phrase right-wing, I think they're often revealing more where they're coming from politically than they are the people that they're talking about. From there, we move on to religious symbols. And there are two cases. This lady here is Nadia Awada. She was an employee of British Airways, and she wanted to wear that very small cross on a uniform. She was told that was against BA uniform rules, which is fair enough, except BA uniform rules said that Sikh could wear Kara bracelets, which are the little bracelet around here, could wear turbans, and Muslims could wear hijabs. She went to the Employment Tribunal and Court of Appeal, and one of the points that came out all the time was visible display of the cross was not a requirement of the Christian faith. The court at that point specifically ignored this case, Sakira Singh, based at Aberdare Girls' School. So Sakira, this young lady here, a Sikh girl at a Welsh school, she wanted to wear that little bracelet, you see, a Kara bracelet. And she won the right to wear it, despite the school's uniform rules. And the judge in that case said, accepted, the claimant is not obliged by her religion to wear the Kara. It is clearly, in her case, an extremely important indication of faith. So two very, very different judgments. And what was interesting, in Awada, they totally ignored the Singh case. And another case, Chaplin, which was a nurse who wanted to wear a crucifix which she'd always worn with her nurse's uniform, the Xing case was ignored as well. That then moved on to what to me is possibly the most disturbing case of all. R versus JFS. Cool. This gentleman, by the way, is the chief rabbi of Great Britain and the Commonwealth, Lord Sacks. JFS School used to be known as the Jewish Free School. And the Jewish Free School was, like all religious schools in the UK, was allowed to discriminate on religious grounds. And it only took children who were Jewish according to Orthodox Jewish law. And according to Jewish law, you're a Jew either because through conversion, but you have to be an adult to convert, or you are the child of a Jewish mother. Judaism is matrilineal. Your descent is through the maternal line. In the case of R, his father was Jewish. His mother was Italian, who had converted to Judaism, but reformed Judaism, not Orthodox Judaism. And therefore, her conversion was not recognized by Orthodox Judaism, and therefore was not recognized by the chief rabbi. Ergo, she was not a Jew. Ergo, her son was not a Jew. And the Supreme Court said, well, sorry, that's illegal. We accept the fact that Jews have been applying this rule for 3,000 years, but it's racist, it's illegal now. And they said, well, you're only against this boy because his mother was Italian. Lord Rogers said, well, who was in the minority, and this was a 5-4 judgment, very much on the balance, said, well, no, it wasn't ethnic. It was to do with the fact that her conversion wasn't recognized as valid under Orthodox Judaism. But the court said, no, basically, we decide he's a Jew. And as I remarked in the Catholic Herald at the time, what next? Does a court say, well, sorry, we know the Pope doesn't regard this person as a Catholic, but we do? You know, where do you stop? It's actually hitting, I think, the very fundamentals of religious independence. If an organization cannot even choose, any organization, whether it's religious or not, cannot even choose its own membership, what freedom do you really have? The Pope drew attention to this in his speech, in Westminster Hall. An interesting place to pick, because Westminster Hall was the spot where Thomas More was condemned and subsequently executed. And the thing at the top is Catholic care. What happened in Britain is when we introduced the sexual orientation regulations, which covered goods and services, adoption services were included within the definition of goods and services. In lots of countries in Europe, they're not. We had 20 Catholic adoption agencies, which most of which had been connected with the church for over 100 years. They got a lot of their money from collections in churches and schools. They did provided a variety of services, including adoption services. What they did was, their job wasn't to arrange adoptions. Adoptions are still arranged through the courts. The job of the aid agencies was to find parents. Where local authorities couldn't find parents for certain children, they would go to the adoption agencies, particularly the Catholic adoption agencies, who had a very, very, very good record in finding parents for difficult-to-adopt children, children who were disabled, children who were older, children who had problems, and they had a very good record in that. But they wanted to say, well, we want our parents to be married, to be male and female, what we might call a traditional married relationship. They were told, well, no, that's illegal under the sexual orientation regulations. There is an exemption in the sexual orientation regulations for charities, and this is not unique. All areas of equality law in the UK have an exemption for charities, so that if you want to set up a charity that only deals with people with spina bifida, that technically is discrimination. But of course, it's a charity, so you're allowed to do that. If you want to set up a if you say, I want to set up a charity for Nigerian students visiting England who can get scholarships, well, that's racially discriminatory, but it's allowed. Because, This is my £1 million. I want to give it to a good cause, but I decide what the good cause is. So that was the Catholic Care applied to amend its constitution to take advantage of the that exemption in the law. I don't think they actually followed the best legal route, but I don't want to get too technical about it. And they were turned down by the Charity Commission. Now, the Charity Commission regulates charities in Britain, and it has the job of approving changes. Traditionally, the changes have always been to make sure that you don't change your constitution so that the trustees are suddenly paid, you know, 50,000 a year or something like that. But they said, well, no, we're not going to allow you to amend your constitution because, well, discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation is a serious matter. Yes, it is. We accept that. But, you know, we are a religious organisation. We have a particular view and ethos, and we want to live in accordance with that. And that particular aspect of charity was ignored by the Charity Commission. So, basically, the Catholic adoption agencies have had to close, or cease being adoption agencies, or cease being Catholic agencies, which a lot of them have done. So, and this was really what this was the part of the Pope's speech in Westminster Hall that leapt out at me, and I've actually added it to the side of my blog. I'd actually written much the same thing a few months later. I don't think the Pope got the idea from reading my blog, however. But it is the point about, I think, in a free society, if we aspire to be a free society, then that means not just individuals, but groups and organisations need the right to their own personality and their own independence. What I fear is happening is that all organisations in Britain are being crushed into a simple monochrome sameness, and diversity isn't being allowed. I was asked one interview in radio once, why do you think religious freedom is important? And I said, ask me the question again, but take out the word religious. Why is freedom important? Because that really is what it is all about. Religious freedom is important because freedom is important. The freedom of religious organisations is important to me because I think the survival of a free society depends upon the interaction of free individual organisations which are treated with respect. That, I fear, is not what is happening with our law and the way it's being applied. Thank you very much.
Now, we're grateful to Neil for giving us a quick run through many of the cases that have emerged in the UK. That was, as he said, very much a UK perspective. There will later be, I think, more of an Irish perspective. And there's an opportunity. There are still some seats in the front row. There's four more seats, I think, here if anybody wishes to take them. Now, it's an opportunity for response. Questions, comments, what we would prefer is that there are not major speeches from the floor. But if you want to ask a question or make a brief comment, that would be welcome. Yes, some hands over there. Are you going to carry the microphone to them? Please, thank you very much. If you just stand up and make your comment, please.
You made a point in relation to the Catholic Care not going down the correct legal route, and I was just wondering, had you something to say in relation to that? Because it seems that the Charitable Commission only looked at it in one way, whereas the need of the children that they were adopting, like, who were, as you said, some of them were disabled and difficult children, that was a greater need than the way they went down the actual simply charity route, I think. Had you something to elaborate on that?
Right. I said I don't want to get too bogged down in the legal technicalities. The way Catholic Care worded their application, their amendment, was the charity will only provide adoption services to heterosexual parents in accordance with the teaching of the Catholic Church. My own view and my own advice to them, which they ignored, was don't refer to heterosexual persons. Just say the charity will provide its services in accordance with the teaching of the Catholic Church. That is what has happened in Scotland. A Scottish Catholic charity, and I've been in consultation with their legal advisers in Scotland, they did amend their constitution on that basis, which is simply the charity provides all its services, not just adoption services, in accordance with the teachings of the Catholic Church. The consequences of that were that they don't offer the services to same-sex couples, they don't offer their services to unmarried couples. And they have no problems. Because once you get the exemption, anybody's got to challenge you, has got to challenge you through the courts. It's getting the exemption approved by the Charity Commission was the problem in Britain. So that's why, as I say, I think, in a way, all right, I'm a lawyer, don't be too honest about what you're trying to do. I'm a lawyer. If I want to draft something my client, that's what I'll do. And my advice to them was just simply say you provide all your services in accordance with the teaching of the Catholic Church.
There was another hand raised in that area, please. In fact, two more.
Just a comment I wanted to add. As a very young nurse, I worked in England in the 1970s, and I worked on a gynae ward. There we had people coming in for abortions and people coming in for different problems. But as a very, very young person, with my Catholic faith, I didn't want to partake in any of these. And, going back all those years, that was totally accepted. I didn't have to partake in any of that. The aftercare, yes. And I just was thinking, look, we've moved on all these years, and, with all the pros and cons of what's right and what's wrong, it makes me wonder, how did we write then? And, where are we going now?
Okay,
that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Another comment or question in that area, and then we'll come down to this section.
I think we can accept that there has to be some limitations on religious practice in that you can't set up a new religion, which is sort of off the wall. But what criteria, apart from taking it on a case-by-case basis, can you offer to say what those limitations are?
I think it's back on the basic problem of proportionality, isn't it? How much is this going to affect the business, the whatever service you're offering? As going back to Lily and the Dells case, it wouldn't have affected the operation of the service to give credence and acceptance to her religious beliefs. If she was in a sort of one-person office somewhere, then maybe it wouldn't have been practical. But I think it is starting off from the basis that we will try to accommodate your religious beliefs if, all other factors being equal, if we can do so. What I think is happening is, if we happen to disagree with your religious belief, we will not accommodate it come what may.
Can we move down to this section? There's a man here, in fact, two in reddish sweaters.
Just a simple question, I think. From my own ignorance, I don't know, have the biological parents any rights with regard to where their child can be placed with an adoptive parent?
All right. I'm delighted you asked, because it's, like all lawyers, I like to talk about cases I win. Thomas More Legal Centre got contacted by a lady in Brighton. She's a Filipino lady who'd had a nervous breakdown and her son had to be taken into care. It wasn't any fault of hers, and that was accepted. She still kept contact with her son, but she wasn't in any fit state to look after him. After a period, he was then going to be fostered with a same-sex couple, and she was upset about this, and the sort of local authority said, well, nothing we can do, we must put it, and she had what she called a mental health advocate, somebody who's supposed to represent her, who spent their entire time telling her that she was wrong. Then she got in contact with me, and I then got in contact with the local authority. And anyway, cut a long story short, I said to them, well, under the Children Act, you're supposed, in fostering, to have regard to a child's cultural, racial, and religious heritage. Now, on what base? You're putting a half Filipino, Roman Catholic boy in with two white, English, gay people. And what regard are you paying to his cultural, racial, religious heritage? And or the views of the parents, which is another thing you're supposed to have regard to under the Children Act. And if we go to court, you're going to have to produce the records where you consider those issues. Well, it never went to court, because I'm pretty certain they'd never even thought of it. So, yes, they are supposed to have regard to these aspects. Whether they do, I think, is very questionable.
Second row, gentlemen in the red sweater, please. The microphone's here.
It's very sad to hear that England has gone down the road of determining what's core religious matter. I've always regarded England as the epitome of pragmatism and live and let live. It seems to be changing, and it would seem that homogeneity is going to be the rule. They're going to determine everything. They hold all the trump cards. They determine what's trumps, and then nothing stands against it. It's homogeneity down the line.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of live and let live is very much at the core of, I'd always understood, sort of Englishness, if you like, to try and put a flavour on it. You know, you don't have to agree with everybody, you just sort of get along with them. And that is, I think, what is lacking now. We are, I think the whole thing on these cases, they are being driven ideologically rather than pragmatically. And that is a concern.
Way over on the far side, lady on the second row, please. Are there other hands about to be raised?
Okay. I'm listening to all the people now have all got rights except Christians, it seems. And I feel that I know we haven't had to fight for our rights in the past, but I feel now that we are being supine, we're being accepting discrimination against Christians, and that we're sitting back and accepting that. And I feel that, you know, we have homosexual rights, we have women's rights, we have all these different rights, and now it seems to be okay to discriminate against Christians, and we're just saying we're going to accept it, and we'll move the goalposts to accept everything, accept our rights. Now, I feel that we need to take a strong stand for our rights and not just accept the treatment that they're dealing out to Christians at this moment. So I wonder what we can do about that. Thank you.
Well, we have, you know, we are citizens of democratic societies. We have to be involved with it. You know, these type of things, like the Iona Institute and so forth, we have to play a part. I think we tended to assume the position of Christianity is safe and just accepted as part of a society, and not accepted that we have to become involved in our society on that basis. We are citizens, and we should participate fully.
But we're accepting discrimination against us.
Well, I think it's a long game, you know. If one looks 20, 30 years ago, the issue of homosexual rights has changed drastically in society's attitudes. Society's attitudes can change again. You know, we have to be more engaged in the political process. I think at a level of principle, and my principle is to try to keep emphasizing freedom, not necessarily religious freedom, but the concepts of freedom, the concepts of live and let live, the concepts of accommodation in a tolerant society. Those are virtues that everybody pays lip service to, but I don't think are being applied, and I think we need to try and pursue them. That is part of, if we want to develop as a democratic society, then we need to have those virtues.
Yes, sir.
In England, with the laws that you have been speaking about, has there been any person who gives a service to the public, like a registrar of births, marriages and deaths, has anybody in that area refused to do that or to give that service and ended up in prison? Has that happened? Because it looks like that's the way we're heading in Ireland. So a little word on that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I was a little bit astonished by the fact that it is a criminal offence in Ireland for a registrar to refuse to perform a marriage or a civil partnership. In Britain, it's not a religious it's not a criminal offence for a registrar to refuse to perform a marriage. It's a disciplinary employment matter. It's not criminal. I don't know why that was necessary to be put in the law in the first place, but, you know, that's a different situation. In Britain, that doesn't apply in Britain because it isn't actually a criminal offence as such.
Now, we're getting near to the end of the questions. Another question here, please, and maybe one or two more.
I'm just wondering, do you think that the channeling of public funds to institutions makes a principled difference in accommodation? I don't know if you're aware, but the overwhelming majority of our primary schools, say, are Catholic in ethos, but financed by the state. So whereas in a private Catholic school, you might question a teacher who's living an openly gay lifestyle, them taking a position and then taking a discrimination case if they're dismissed. But if it's the case that you have a school that's publicly financed and then dismissing a teacher who is openly gay, do you think that because we have voted in discrimination laws and we have an equality code, that we should make have more of a balancing act in that regard?
It's a difficult one, isn't it, when you're taking public money. I mean, part of the question that was asked by Vin Nicholls, Archbishop Westminster, prior to the sexual orientation regulations coming in was, okay, if our adoption agency don't take any public money at all, and we fund that service ourselves entirely, would you then give an exemption? They said no. So it's not just the public money. That's the point that's often raised, but it isn't actually the core of the issue, because Catholic Care is a charity. It has private funding. And I mean, with Catholics, because I can't speak for the situation in Ireland, but in Britain, we have Church of England, we have Catholic schools, and they are publicly funded, but there is also quite a large element which is found by the churches themselves. And, you know, that's a balancing exercise. Do you want churches and other organisations to do the jobs that they do very well or not?
I think our last two questions, one here and one in the very back row, I saw a hand.
Thank you. Just listening to your programme, Judy, tonight about this question, where it has to be remembered that everybody pays tax. So Catholics who are running a school are entitled to part of that tax, like as far as when they're giving education. You know, you can't. Just it seems to me like on the other basic point, that the secularists are appropriating to themselves the right to make moral law, which is steps completely away from the natural law. And this is the prime problem, which you mentioned in relation to the American Constitution, First Amendment, I think you said.
Thank you. Do you want to respond?
No, I mean...
We'll take the last question then, and maybe it might link in. Yes, sir.
Richard Dalton is my name. Listening on and looking at your presentation, it strikes me that England did not become the country it is today overnight, that there are lessons to be learned, that we've seen creeping introduction of such legislation, and we need to be aware of it in Ireland, that we may be somewhat lazy in opposing the initial piece of legislation because it's just the initial, and we may be cocooned into thinking that, well, it won't go any further. But that is the case that has happened in England. The second point is that, just in case it goes out that this is just a Roman Catholic problem, if you like, the main churches in the Protestant faith are also subject to this creeping and aggressive secularism. And I'd refer people to Luther. He actually saw that unbridled toleration was as much an offence to religion in his day as it is in our day.
Thank you, sir. A final response?
Yeah, I mean, just an interesting point. I mean, when the Equality Act was going through, there was suggestion, because at that time the Church of England were discussing the issue of women bishops, that, you know, it was suggesting Parliament, well, what we'll do is we'll simply legislate that, you know, the Church of England must allow women bishops. You know, I realise there is a particular constitutional status of the Church of England in England, but it nevertheless, I think, expressed the view. I mean, there was real challenges whether or not Catholics should, churches should be allowed to, say, not have women priests, on, and should the state just say, well, we don't allow discrimination. That wasn't allowed, but I think it indicates an attitude of mind, which is that as a state, the state has the power and the right to do this. Okay.
Thank you. Could we give a round of applause, please?